We'd like to do a little audience participation.
See the way he walks down the street. That's the way he shuffles his feet. What is ever standing by when he goes walking by? He's my guy. When he holds my hand, I'm so proud. 'Cause I'm not just one of the crowd.
This is J.D. Doyle for Queer Music Heritage, and that was the San Francisco band Buena Vista singing He's a Rebel. I came out in 1978, and so did the documentary Word Is Out, which included that music clip. So that was one of the very first images I saw of an act singing songs male to male. That song also made a big impression on me because I was a hardcore fan of the girl group sound of the 1960s, and the song by the Crystals was one of the best. I just mentioned the film Word Is Out, and it was one of the very first full-length lesbian and gay documentaries. Its full title was Word Is Out, Stories of Some of Our Lives, and it was just that. It was made up of interviews with more than 20 lesbians and gay men telling of their lives. It was produced by a team led by Peter and Nancy Adair, who were brother and sister filmmakers. And while it included some more known people, like Harry Hay and Pat Bond, I think the more powerful stories were by just the ordinary folks. If you haven't seen this film, I recommend you track it down. It's not just good history, it's good filmmaking. And of course, I love that the film included some music interludes, my first chance to see lesbian and gay musicians on film. Trish Nugent sang a very poignant song called Were You There? But the act that really captured my attention was Buena Vista. Buena Vista was a very popular band in San Francisco in the late 1970s, and I'm pleased that I have Andrew Brown, one of the founding members, to tell us about the band.
The story I want to capture is how the band Buena Vista got started and how they evolved.
I originally started singing at you've been to San Francisco?
Yes.
You know Glide Church?
I've heard of it. I don't know where it is.
We all sang at Glide. It was 1975. So I went there, and some other people were going there at the time. And we liked the church, but the choir wasn't getting respect. Let's put it that way. And so I decided that a group of us should get a band together and start playing. And this is before I ever got the job with the film. So I helped get this band together. We didn't have a name. There were four of us at the time, and a piano player. So we were all singing at Glide, and we decided to get, you know, started singing apart from the choir.
So who were the first members of the group?
Terry Hutchinson, Gomer, me, Joe Nathan. We used to call him, he was the piano player, Joe. And then we used Freddie as a bass player. It was the Joe Nathan, who was the piano player, and Freddie, who was my boyfriend, who was in the film, Freddie Gray. He was the bass player.
So about when was the band formed, you know?
Of 1975.
Who would you say were the band's musical influences?
Oh, they liked all the women singers, especially LaBelle. And they sort of patterned themselves after LaBelle.
Well, of the first members of the group, kind of, who did what?
Terry had the big voice and was the lead, did most of the leads. Gomer saw himself as Sarah Dash or Patti LaBelle.
That's Michael Gomes.
Michael Gomes. And so it was basically Terry and Gomer. And then there was Kenny Ross was one of the first members also.
So did you do much of the singing or?
I did some of the singing, but what happened, I got the job making the film. I had to go to move to New York for a while. So I sort of left them.
Kind of phased out of it for a while.
Well, I still managed the band.
Yeah.
I was managing the band and helping them get gigs. And then what happened, during the film, they needed music. And Peter saw them sing somewhere and came to me and said, well, I want to use them in the movie.
I've read one review describing the band's live show as, and this is a quote, something like the Supremes strained through a male sensibility and then spewed out with a lot of lust.
Yes, definitely. I mean, they did a lot of oldies. Fortunately, Terry was an old folk singer, so he had a huge voice. He could do a lot of riffs like Patti. So he would go on these long forays into singing, you know, these sort of LaBelle songs. But he could also sing. He had his own style. So he was a great singer.
Was he kind of the crowd favorite or standout?
Gomer was a crowd favorite when it came to singing high. But Terry was a crowd favorite in terms of singing solos because he could really put across a ballad.
Was there a song that was the crowd favorite?
Well, they did a lot of oldies, but then we started doing some original stuff, like Hot Magazine. You've heard that one.
Yep.
On the 45. That was written by Jerry Kirby. Jerry Kirby was a background singer for Sylvester. I got him to sort of arrange a song by Blackberry. Do you know Blackberry?
I do know him.
Okay. And now he's a friend of mine. He lives in Oakland. So Blackberry had written this song, He's Okay, and I needed a better up-tempo arrangement rather than a folk arrangement. So I got Jerry Kirby to arrange He's Okay for his singers.
Let's stop and hear that song. It was one side of their only 45 RPM release. Again, it was originally written and sung by Blackberry under the title It's Okay, and they changed it slightly to He's Okay.
I remember growing as a child, I had a childhood lover. And like two boys would often do, we would cling to each other. I was slightly older, though we both were only 10. And I wonder if he loves me now, like we did each other then. For me, he's okay, okay. Can't you see? He's good for me. He's okay. And as I grew into my teens, my love grew for that guy. Together.
soon now. Ooh, I'll be led, but not in the wrong sense. Search my soul till I felt at home. Now I feel somehow, turn, I feel somehow that I understand.
Jerry had done a lot of arranging for Sylvester, too, and was one of his background singers, with somebody who's now a transsexual, lives in Texas, Arno Elzy. They had a group, their own group, Jerry and Arnold. But at the time, they sang with Sylvester, it was Jerry, Arnold, and Lady Bianca. They were the three background singers for Sylvester before Sylvester got the Two Tons of Fun. And Jerry Kirby still lives in Tenderloin, but I know he's transitioned also.
Really?
Yeah.
Another important piece of the band's story is their drummer, Richard Dworkin, or as he was called then, Dickie. Here is him telling about how he got into the band Buena Vista.
Buena Vista was a group in San Francisco that, when I joined it, was composed entirely of gay men. And it was based around three Caucasian singers: Terry Hutchison, Michael Gomes, or Gomer as he was known to his friends, and Kenny Ross, who were inspired by the music of LaBelle and rhythm and blues singers like them. I believe that they had met around the choir at Glide Church, and they were somehow brought together by a man named Andrew Brown. And Joe, whose last name I can't remember, was the piano player at Glide, and he played piano for them. And Andrew was the boyfriend of a bass player named Freddie Gray. And I was in New York in 1976, in the summer of 1976, with a dance music theater troupe on a three-month tour. And one day in June, several of us were busking at Christopher and 7th Avenue in Sheridan Square. And Andrew saw us playing and talked to me afterwards. And when I got back to San Francisco, he invited me to audition for this band, Buena Vista. And at the time, they didn't have a trap drummer. They had a conga player, which was a little odd for the kind of music that they were making. So I started playing with them from 1976 to November 1978.
I want to interject that Richard Dworkin is not just someone I pulled out of the blue. He's an old friend to Queer Music Heritage, as I've interviewed him extensively in the past about Michael Callan, Stephen Grossman, and others. He's touched an amazing amount of our music history. Andrew and I are going to talk next about the film Word Is Out, but I wanted to bring in an expert to set that up. Greg Yeomans is a friend of mine in San Francisco, and a couple years ago, he published an entertaining book about the film. Greg also arranged for me to get some very exclusive music to use in this show. This music did not appear in the film, but was recorded for it, and is from the Peter Adair Archives at the San Francisco Public Library. And I greatly thank Greg for that.
Greg, could you tell me briefly about the film Word Is Out and what you feel is its importance in our culture?
Word Is Out was a breakthrough film that appeared at a very important time in gay and lesbian politics. It had been longer in the making, but it appeared at the end of 1977. So just between Anita Bryant launching her campaign at the beginning of that year in Florida, and then as the battle against Senator Briggs in California was shaping up. So it was a key moment in gay rights struggles. And the film was very ambitious in terms of production values and scope and reach. So this is a film that brought together more than 20 gays and lesbians to talk about their lives. It's deceptively simple. They're just there on screen telling about their experiences. But then it's all cut together, and it presents this composite portrait of gay and lesbian people in the U.S. And the film from the beginning was designed to get onto television as well as into theaters. So it had a PBS release, a very broad audience. And it really played a key role in shaping hearts and minds of Americans as they were facing this issue.
Was it the first full-length gay documentary?
I don't think technically you could say that, because there was, for instance, a lesbian-produced film about lesbian custody struggles called In the Best Interest of the Children, and it may have premiered slightly earlier that same year. You know, it was in this moment. But it was the first in which lesbians and gay men were co-making the film. So there were six filmmakers, three women, three men, and it presented gay and lesbian people on screen. And then certainly in terms of scope and reach and all those other things, it was a breakthrough.
What was the importance of the use of music in the film?
That's a really interesting question. Thinking about the music, when I wrote my book about Words About, the music was something I didn't address sufficiently, didn't talk about, because I think it was hard for me to think about the music, really. The music is wonderful in the film, but it's actually maybe the aspect of the film that, depending on how you look at it, dates it most or makes it most dated, because it doesn't feel as universal. It's very specific in terms of genre. It's very 70s. It's folky lesbian music, storytelling music, and then the more disco sound of Buena Vista. But it plays a huge role in the warmth of the film, the energy of the film. It's there as a framing device throughout. So at the very beginning, right after a few snippets from interviews, you get that in the opening credits, and you hear both Buena Vista and Trish Nugent. And then between each of the parts of the film, it returns. So it's very important, I would say, to the film.
I would add that I think this film was among the first times gay and lesbian people got to see gay and lesbian performers on screen.
Mm-hmm. That's a great point. Yeah, that's true.
Anything you want to add?
No. Just because I'm very excited to hear your show, actually. I'm excited that you're interviewing Andrew Brown, one of the makers of the film, and that you've done so much research on Buena Vista, because I love the music and I want to hear more about that scene and its importance.
Here's one of the unreleased tracks from the library archives. It's the Ruby and the Romantics song, Our Day Will Come, only they sing it mostly as Our Day Has Come.
This is a little fight song. It's called Our Day Has Come.
Ooh, our day has come, and we'll have everything. Ooh, we'll share the joy falling in love can bring. Ooh, no one can tell me that I'm too young to know.
Young to know.
I love you so.
Love you so.
And you love me. Day will come if we just wait a while. No tears for us. I think love can wear a smile. Our dreams are magic because we'll always stay in love this way.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Now, let's get back to Andrew Brown, as I wanted to hear his perspective on Word Is Out.
All right, let's get to Word Is Out.
Yes.
Some people may not be familiar with it, so give a little brief description of Word Is Out, the film.
Well, Word Is Out came out around the time of the Briggs Initiative in California, which tried to stop gay people from teaching. And that was coupled with Anita Bryan, who was representing the orange juice industry in Florida. She had come out also against gay people. So there was all this negative experiences, and Peter had been working on the idea of interviewing gay people from across the country, just ordinary gay people,
Peter
to get a sense that people were their brothers, sisters, you know, were, you know, like family members. By the time I became aware of it, they were put an ad in the paper looking for other people to work on this film, and I applied, and you had to make a videotape. And I was here with my boyfriend from Philadelphia, and we all had submitted tapes. And Peter and his sister, Nancy Adair, who's also a lesbian, held interviews, and I was picked. I was picked because I was a minority as much as anything else. So that's how I got the job working on Word Is Out. And they had already made a short version by the time I came on board. When we went to New York, we were sent with videotapes to interview people we knew to do interviews with them. On the way back across the country, we filmed them. And then when we got back to San Francisco, we edited it and put it together.
Were you already in a relationship with Freddie Gray at the time?
Yeah. By the time I started doing the film, I was in a relationship with Freddie Gray.
And he was already in the band?
And he was already in the band.
Okay.
Yeah,
so was it your influence that got the band into the film?
It was my influence. Only because Peter had heard about the Vans. They were playing at a club in San Francisco, and he came by, got a look at their act. And, you know, what band in the right mind wanted to be in a gay film?
Oh, sure.
In the 70s. But they were already out in San Francisco, so that wasn't an issue. So he didn't have to deal with that. But he's the one who suggested it to me, but it was my connection more than my influence.
Well, you were in the film also.
Well, I was in the film, but I had lobbied not to be in the film. And by the time they did the first half and before it went to the second half, when there was this gay liberation theme, they picked my boyfriend because he was a father. He had a daughter, and they wanted a gay man with a child. So Freddie was very easy because he was my lover, and then they wanted to show that he was in a relationship, and I was very clear I did not want to be in the film. I wanted, even before this, I wanted to make it, but I didn't want to be in it. But of course, I had to sort of be with him. And that's how that scene got in there.
Okay, you kind of got corralled.
I got corralled.
Richard Dworkin said I should ask you about the special concert held at the City.
Right. We filmed at the City. The City was a big club with Sylvester Plath. It was you know, other acts. It had a nightclub. It had a dance disco. It was down the street from the Playboy Club. It was in North Beach, you know. There was a big gay population there historically from the 60s and 70s. So we did film a show there that ended up in the film.
And this is the perfect time to let you hear some music recorded at that special concert at the City. And again, I thank Greg Yeomans for obtaining this music for me. This one's titled, Make Your Way.
If you can't make your way, then follow me. Just forget what they tell you to be, and follow me. You don't have to believe anymore in the life they say they have in store for you. I know there's a brighter day, so follow me.
Thank you. trying to get yourself free ain't no easy thing to do. But when you've been down so long, things can look alright to you. When the truth seems such a long ways away, I said, then why don't you come with me? Don't be afraid, start opening up the doors. Between the heat and past, and what the future holds in store. If you think it's time to do the things you got to do, just remember I believe in you. Don't pay to pretend, you know that a friend is a friend who is a someone that will always see you through. Well, don't you be afraid, open up the door. Behind a past and what the future holds in store. If you think it's time to open up your mind, just remember I believe in you. If you can make your way, you can't make your way, then come and follow me. If you can't make your way, if you can't make your way, then come.
With the band being in the film, were they kind of chosen because they were like groundbreakers and being out gay artists?
Well, I think that's one component. I think they were more in the film because they represented San Francisco, too. I mean, here, you know, the Castro was just starting. There was this new influx of gay energy that really was at the end of the hippie free love era that was moving into gay liberation. And they sort of represented it by singing these wildly popular old songs, but basically singing them to men. He's a rebel, you know. The Ronette songs.
You'll be my
so they
baby.
Sang these oldie songs with a gay twist. And they also sang, you know, those songs like Patti LaBelle that all the young gay people were relating to. Lady Marmalade, you know, all those female groups, black female groups, that's who they sort of...
Did they sing mostly cover songs?
They sang mostly cover songs, but started writing their own songs after I left.
Mm-hmm. So the cover songs, they were a lot of female songs, but they did it male-to-male and
made
them gay.
Yes.
And that would have been...
And that's what turned people on.
Right. That would have been new at that time.
Yeah. Yeah. Definitely. And, you know, for all these young gay men in that whole denim era of, you know, that whole clone look from the Castro denim jacket,
right.
Denim pants, hoodie underneath, that was really that crowd that they represented.
Well, to be a gay man there and to be able to hear... At those early stages of liberation,
yeah.
A band singing songs to them must have been exciting.
Well, it's thrilling to men, other men.
Yeah.
Really. They were really turned on by it. Really turned on by it. But then, you know, the disco era was coming into his own, right, too. And we weren't really disco, but it was like forced that way. Because to play a club, they wanted you to
make the crowd dance.
They wanted you to play dance music.
Yeah.
So they started doing things, you know, I Can't Get No Love, hanging out the discotheque, that one.
Right, right.
Yeah, that was one of their big songs. So they sang, you know, songs like that also. So it was that sort of transition period from rock, oldies, yeah, to the Sound of Philadelphia with the 3 Degrees to disco.
On YouTube, there's a rare clip of Buena Vista singing the song we were just talking about, a huge hit by the band Brainstorm called Lovin' Is Really My Game. I wish it were not such an amateur recording, but I guess we are grateful to be able to see this 36-year-old clip at all. The sound is not great, but I wanted to give you a 30-second taste of it.
Let's talk a little bit about the 45. I know Scott Davey produced it, and you and Scott Davey produced it. How did you,
right,
pick those two songs?
Well, Peter and I had a big fight about the song. He thought we should do He's a Rebel because it had more of a connection with the film. I felt I owed it to the band to do something original. Even though He's a Rebel had a more connection with, I thought Hot Magazine talked about the whole sex scene with gay men.
Right, right.
And I thought that was more important than He's a Rebel. And, you know, and He's Okay, I think we did. And that was the original by Blackberry, and I wanted the original for somebody we knew. So I wanted to do two original songs as opposed to having to pay royalties for a song that we really had no connection with.
Mm-hmm. I'm looking at the cover of the 45, or the label of the 45. It said, right, it was written by Jerry Kirby and Horace Jack Tolson.
Yes, I know Jerry. Horace Jack Tolson, I really don't know that well. I think he probably did the musical part of it. And it's probably somebody he played with in his band that he had at the time. But Derry had his own wild band. He and Arnold, that went on for like 3 or 4 years.
How did the 45 go over?
Well, I took it to New York. I went down to LA and had it pressed. I took it to New York with a whole press kit with the film. There, you know, it was in the middle of the whole disco period, you know, so.
Right, this was 78.
Right. And, but, you know, disco was coming into its own. And because it didn't have a heavy disco beat, so it didn't get much play in the end. Because it didn't have that pumping beat behind it.
Time had already changed music.
Right,
music,
right.
As you heard discussed, the song Hot Magazine was one side of the 45 they released, and I'm going to give you instead a live version. Imagine, here was a song talking about gay porn magazines.
Taking a walk down to the bookstore on a lonely, boring day for me. Can't wait to see my latest boyfriend. Under the covers, waiting to be free. Hot magazine, so lovely. Look a sample or two, and you have a pin-up queen. So lovely, spending all of my cash on jars of Vaseline. Hot water dream, proposed.
Oh baby, oh whoa, I love her so.
Green thumbtacks and a pair of scissors. Well, I sweat real hard to wait past three. I cover everything but the bedroom window with pictures of boys who cry and beg for me.
Hot magazine, so lovely, like a staple I do, and you have a pin-up queen. So lovely, spending all of my cash on jars of Vaseline. My laundry dream, my poster scene, my country clean.
Oh baby, oh whoa, I love you so.
You know I'm always reading Playgirl.
I get Penthouse, Screw and Weeks.
Now Hustler is my new toy.
As I turn the page, I know I'll subscribe eventually.
He's black and white and he's in color.
His centerfold's got a hold on me, yeah.
I never read the printed chapter.
Oh no,
cause he's the only thing I see. Hot magazine, so lovely, like a staple I do when you have a pin-up queen. So lovely, spending all of my cash on jars of Vaseline. My country jeans, my books to see, I don't feel clean.
Oh baby, oh whoa, I love you so.
Books never give me any trouble. Or ever talk back mean to me. They only cost $1.50 each, and give me a change in ecstasy. Hot magazine, so lovely, like a staple I do when you have a pin-up queen. So lovely, spending all of my cash on jars of Vaseline. My country dream, my books to see, I come to see.
Oh baby, oh, oh, I love it so.
All right, yeah. Going down, going down, going down, going down, going down.
Trivia. Yes, the band Buena Vista was named after the, at least then, very cruisy San Francisco park by that name. And here's an extra. I have two jingles that Buena Vista recorded in 1978 for a benefit called Join Hands, a gay prisoner support group. It aired on the Berkeley FM station KPFA and is courtesy of the San Francisco GLBT Historical Society.
If we don't let nothing get in our way, we can make it to a brighter day.
Did you hear about the benefit for Join Hands?
No, what's Join Hands?
Join Hands is a gay prisoner support group, and they're having a benefit with KPFA Friday night, March 24th.
KPFA, that's that listener-sponsored radio station.
That's right. It's going to be at 8 o'clock at the Gay Community Center in San Francisco, 330 Grove Street.
Wait, 330 Grove Street.
And Blackberry and Friends and Buena Vista are going to perform.
Oh, wow, Buena Vista, that gospel rock group. I mean, they have these gospel and rock songs all mixed. It's great. Wow. When is it?
8 o'clock. Friday night, March 24th at the Gay Community Center, 330 Grove Street, benefit for Join Hands and KPFA.
I'm going to go.
If we don't let nothing get in our way, we can make it to a brighter day. But I don't want to miss the sign, so I need your light with mine. If we don't let nothing get in our way, make it day.
Join Hands is a gay prisoners support group, and on Friday night, March 24th, Join Hands and KPFA are going to have a benefit at San Francisco Gay Community Center at 330 Grove Street. It's going to have the special sounds of Blackberry and Friends and Buena Vista, the hot gospel rock band, and there's going to be dancing through the night. So be there Friday night, March 24th, at the San Francisco Gay Community Center, 330 Grove Street, for a benefit for Join Hands, the Gay Prisoners Support Group, and KPFA Listener Sponsored Radio.
If we don't let nothing get in our way, we can make it to a brighter day. But I don't want to miss the sign, so I need your light with mine.
What venues did the band typically play, and where were they best received?
Well, they're best received, I would say, at any gay event, definitely. The Stud, of course, in San Francisco was a big place for them. It was a gay hippie bar where Eddie James used to play.
Yes, Richard says those are his favorite memories at the Stud.
Yeah, the Stud. I mean, even Robert De Niro's dad used to show his, he was an artist, and he used to have his pictures up around the Stud. But the Stud was the bar, especially the hippie bar, which we sort of represented in some ways. And they loved that to death.
Richard Dworkin, their drummer, has similar memories of the Stud.
I don't know how many gigs I played in my life, certainly over 1,000 or maybe 2,000 or maybe more, but I think maybe the most fun I ever had playing was playing with Buena Vista at the Stud in 1976 or 1977. And the Stud was a gay bar on Folsom Street in San Francisco. And it was the bar that all the hippie fags hung out in through the 70s. And for a while, they would have live music occasionally. They had Etta James play there many times, which was really quite exciting. I can't remember who else played there. Probably, I'm sure Sylvester played there. I don't know who else played there, but we played there 3 times. And what was exciting about Buena Vista was that, in San Francisco at least, there hadn't been any instance of gay men making a pop band or a rock band or a rhythm and blues band and singing love songs to other men. So there were 2 things about it. One, that the lyrics were overtly gay. And 2, that gay men were actually playing drums and electric bass and other tools of the trade. It was really wonderful to play at the Stud and feel that we were the sort of voice of a community. That was really quite wonderful and something that none of us had ever experienced.
I think the band played at both the 1977 and 1978 Gay Freedom Day celebration.
Right. And I was around for that time. Well, you know, it's really in the middle of a big movement, and the band ended up representing a lot of those feelings, you know? So they had a big following because of that. They would do all the street fairs. They played around. They traveled around California and played places.
I spotted them in the film Gay USA, and unfortunately, it doesn't have them audio. It just shows them briefly,
right,
which was irritating.
Right. They really embodied a feeling from people from that era because they were so out on stage. And, you know, they act like mad little queens.
They camped it up.
And people really related to that, really.
How long did the band last, and why did it break up?
Well, it lasted up until 1980 at least. I think it really broke up because Terry realized he needed more exposure, and he was the lead singer, and he ended up going to New York for a couple of years. I mean, that's the main reason, you know, without a lead singer, you're not going to have a band. And he felt the need, he needed to go to New York, which he ended up doing.
Do you have any special memories of the band you could share?
My memories of the band are really fun. I mean, when I first met Terry, he and I hung out a lot. So we went to Golden Gate Park to hear Mickey Hart of the Grateful Dead. That's my connection to Terry. We became very good friends. Gomer, me, and Terry were all Libras, so we all clicked really well. So they were my closest friends, and I loved them to death. And I just remember us having such a good time during that period, and we really sort of left the church to have our own group because we weren't being recognized. And that's the point of, you know, we were all in the church, but now that Goliath is such a big gay church, they were doing gay marriages, but back then it was sort of unspoken. We got support, but it wasn't really talked about.
Mm-hmm.
But my memory is really hanging out in the choir with them because we were all, well, it was like a party choir. We did a lot of gospel concerts with all the black gospel groups, so we would hang out on Sunday evenings and do gospel. And then we would get together and sing gospel music. And then it drifted into popular music and R&B.
I was on the trail of trying to interview Terry a couple of years ago, and someone had given me an email address, and I sent that off. I had questions already, and I didn't hear anything. I don't know if he didn't get it, or, you know, the wrong email was wrong, or he just didn't reply. But then 3 weeks later, he died.
Yeah. Yeah, that was sad. Yeah, it was hard to track Terry down. I used to see him around the city, but not much. He and I ended up hanging out a couple of months before he died, a lot. He managed a club here for years and then stopped doing that and sort of like retired.
He had done several recordings too.
Oh, yeah, on his own.
Yes.
That's when he was in New York. He had done a lot of recording in New York. Some things I'm not even aware of, it, you know. But then came back here and just started managing a club, a big club here south of Market.
What do you think is the legacy of Buena Vista?
Interesting question. I'm just aware that people became aware that you could be gay and out and popular, witnessed by Sylvester. Sylvester was the first, I really think, but even before Sylvester, but of that kind of genre. Sylvester, for some reason, felt a little, not pressure, but the All in One Sylvester wasn't the only option, let's put it that way, out there. And all of us, of course, respected him because he really had done a lot. But I think it represented more than for a black singing group. Here was a white singing group that was doing campy stuff and popular music who were good and people liked. And that you can be out and sing. Now, it didn't happen right away, but I really think they presented an image of having a good time and not being sort of brought down by the pressures of being out and gay. That's what I would say the legacy is.
Very good. Are there any questions about the band I should ask that I perhaps would not know to ask?
Well, it's interesting because I think the band represented an era of gay liberation in San Francisco for no other reason than they were in the film. But, you know, music is meant to be had, you know, to bring back good memories and good times. And I think music for everybody is an escape, in spite of what you're singing about. It's there to offer relief, to offer good memories. And I think that's what music is about, having people forget all their problems for a minute and just enjoy themselves. And in the end, I think that's what the band was about, and its legacy is about that. In spite of the pressures of the time of people coming down on gay people and their image, and, you know, Harvey Milk being murdered, that we wanted to have a good time and forget the sort of issues around gay liberation, because the big argument in the film during the time, or about the film, was if you're saying that you're gay, is that a political statement? And that was a big fight, even when making the film. The fact that you say you're gay ends up being a political statement in the 70s. And even now, once you say you're gay, I mean, you sort of have to defend yourself. So it's not an innocent, neutral statement. Let's put it that way. And I think back then, even more so, to be on the stage and say that you're gay, all at once, it brings along a lot of other issues that you can't ignore. And I think we made it easier for people to say, hey, part of being gay is having a good time.
This is J.D. Doyle, and I want to thank Andrew Brown, Richard Dworkin, and Greg Yeomans for their comments. And I thank you for listening to Queer Music Heritage. I'm closing with another live unreleased track by Buena Vista, and I think it's a very cool one, as it's some of the material the crowds really loved. It's a medley of 60s female hits, including Be My Baby, Hello Stranger, and the song that started the show, He's a Rebel.
Be my baby now.
I wanna know my baby.
shabba, my baby, shabba, shabba, hello, stranger. I've seen you again. How long has it been? Ooh, it seems like a mighty long time. Shabop, shabop, my baby. Ooh,
it seems like a mighty long time.
It seems like a mighty long time. Shabop, shabop, my baby, ooh. It seems like a mighty long time. Shabop, shabop, my baby. 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 Shabop, shabop. My baby, shibab shibab. My baby, shibab shibab. My baby, shibab shibab. My baby,
shibab shibab. My baby, shibab shibab. Please don't leave me like you did before. I still love you so. Oh, it seems like a mighty long time.
Shibab shibab, my baby, you. Seems like a mighty long time. Shabba shabba, my baby. 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 Shabba shabba.
Hello, stranger.
See the way he walks down the street. That's the way he shuffles his feet. He's my guy.
Thank you.
Thank you. Hope y'all got a little bit of 1961 with that, honey.